So those of you who are parents probably have the experience of children asking difficult questions. Actually, I was talking to Alan on the phone this week, and we were talking about Callum and how Callum asks sometimes some pretty tough questions, right? So you know that they're going to ask these kinds of questions. Now, parents will go the other direction, though, when they're dealing with their children. So the parents will say, if you want to go to your grandparents tomorrow, then you must behave. You must do something. You must be of good behavior. This word must is called an auxiliary verb. And so it's added, for instance, we could say, you must study to be ready for an exam, or you must remain seated until the plane has come to a complete stop at the gate, or if you get into your car, you must wear your seat belts. So wear is a verb. The must is what's called an auxiliary verb. Remain seated. Seated is a verb. The must is an auxiliary verb. So when Jesus speaks, sometimes he uses, in the Greek and in the English, this auxiliary verb. The most classic one that we all know is in John chapter 4, where Jesus says, you must be born again. And he says that to Nicodemus. You must be born again. Now, the actual expression, you must be, occurs a few times. But as I told you last week, when over the next few weeks, Rod and I will be alternating, but going forward, when I'm preaching in the morning, I'm going to preach through the seven must-be statements that Jesus makes. And so he says, Scripture must be fulfilled. And that's the one we looked at last week. He then says, and this is what we're going to look at today, and I'm looking at them in not in chronological order, but in more of a theological order. The Son of Man must be lifted up, and we're going to look at that one today. Then we're going to look at, God willing, in a few weeks, you must be born again. And then some challenges that he's going to present beyond that. You must be perfectly obedient. You must be a servant. And then finally, you must be prepared for the second coming of Jesus. There's one more that he makes, and that is, and it's a collective, the church must be new wine. So there's certain ones that are addressed to us individually, like you must be born again, you must be perfectly obedient, you must be a servant, you must be prepared, but there's also a collective that the church must be new wine. So we're going to look at these. We looked at one last week. We're going to look at one today, and then eventually the remaining five, God willing. When I was probably 9, 10 years old, in that range, maybe up until about the time I was 12 or so, I used to like reading comic books. And there was like Spider-Man and Superman and Batman. But looking at comparing Superman and Batman, I didn't particularly like the Superman in comparison to Batman. And do you know why that was? Because Superman was basically invincible. Nothing could harm him except kryptonite. And so actually excuse the expression here, but he was a god. He could not be harmed except with kryptonite. Whereas I prefer Batman because from my perspective as a teenage boy, it was so cool, all of his gadgets, and he's just a mere man, but he had all this smarts and he could do these things. And so I preferred Batman over Superman. So it was the idea of a superhuman that bothered me, even when I was an early teen. Well, when you think about it, and in some respects, this is what the Jews were expecting of the Messiah. And actually, in some respects, they were correct, because Jesus is the God-man. But when he came into the world, he came in with a human nature, and he wasn't invincible. He could get sick. He could have human emotions, like crying at the tomb of Lazarus. He could die. He had to grow from a little infant. He could get hungry, those kinds of things. And so he was, in a sense, mortal, because he could die. Now, he's certainly the God-man. So, but the Jews were looking for a Superman. That's what they were expecting. And you can see their interpretation of this when the disciples asked Jesus multiple times during his ministry, is the kingdom going to come, and are you going to conquer the Romans, and are you going to make us into a great super empire all over again? That's what the expectation was. They wanted to see the Seleucids conquered. They wanted to see Rome conquered by a Superman. And they wanted a Davidic kingdom set up that would last forever. Well, actually, the Davidic kingdom does last forever, because Jesus is the direct descendant of David, and he is the king, and it goes on. But they misunderstood, believing that an earthly kingdom was going to be set up rather than, well, let's use the term, eschatological kingdom, the permanent spiritual kingdom that would eventually be manifest in the new heavens and earth. And so they were surprised, because their expectation was not met. And what are some of the things that didn't meet their expectation? Well, here he was, born in a manger, not in a mighty palace. He said, "My kingdom is not of this world." He was ridiculed and mocked, and this bothered Peter. He suffered injustices and the indignities, and that's partly why we read from the Isaiah passage, because it's very clear prophecy of what Jesus would suffer. And he was accused of being a criminal, and he was crucified between two criminals. And he suffered all of the beatings and the thorns and all this. This isn't what they were expecting the Messiah to be like. Ironically, Jesus had told them multiple times what his kingdom would be like. 3.5 years, approximately, these disciples had been with him as he'd been going around in Galilee and in Samaria and in Judea, and they didn't understand. In fact, in the book of Acts, they again, when he's going up into heaven, they ask him again, "Are you going to restore the kingdom?" They had a total misunderstanding of what he was going to do. And so what is the truth that we are to see? Well, Jesus says in Luke that the Messiah must be delivered up. Must be delivered up is the first thing he says, and that's in Luke 24, verses 6 and 7. He must be delivered up. So what is it first that it means? We ask, who is doing the delivering, and to whom is he being delivered? So who is doing the delivering? Well, in Psalm 41, we read that my good friend has basically delivered me up, the fulfillment of the prophecy. You think about this. throughout that 3.5 years, Judas was in their midst. And Jesus knew that Judas was going to be his betrayer. By the way, if you ever start complaining about your fellow Christians and you wish they would behave differently, remember what Jesus put up with for 3.5 years with Judas in their midst. So none of us are hopefully Judases, but think about that. So it was a friend. My friend has delivered me up. What did he do? For 30 pieces of silver, basically a month's wage. That's what he did. But who else delivered him up? Well, it was the Father. And you read that in Acts 2:23 in Peter's sermon, where he says that it was through the direct providence of God that Jesus was delivered up. And then he said, but you did it, the Jewish leaders, but it was the Father who delivered it up. So it was a friend and it was a father. This is who did the delivering. And Judas did the delivering by betraying him and then by, in the Garden of Gethsemane, leading the band of soldiers that went out to arrest him. So a friend and the Father in the providence, in his ultimate providence, delivered up. Friend and Father. But then to whom was he delivered? Well, he was delivered to his foes, because he was delivered to the antagonistic Jewish leaders. He was delivered to the Roman leaders. Jew and Gentile both were his foes in this instance. They hated him. They did not want him to set up his spiritual kingdom. They were threatened by that. They thought that people would go over to him and that they would lose their authority. And so he was delivered up to his foes, but he was also delivered up to the Father. The sacrifices that were offered during the thousands of years from the time of Abraham onward, actually going back to Noah, all that time when these sacrifices were being delivered up, they were pointing to Jesus when he came. And those sacrifices went up to the Lord, to Jehovah, to the Father. And so when Jesus replaced those sacrifices, he was being offered up as the final, ultimate sacrifice that all of the other animal sacrifices pointed to. And so he was delivered up as a sacrifice to the Father. And what is interesting is, because he's God, he delivered up himself to the Father. And so this is an absolutely mind-blowing concept, that the Father delivered up and he was delivered up to the Father. I won't take a digression here, but this is the only way that God could satisfy his justice and his mercy, is through the sacrifice of Jesus. You remember what Peter tried to do at multiple points in the ministry. 3 times, Peter attempted to derail the ministry of Jesus. On the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter said, "Whoa, you're here, let's build these little tabernacles, and you and Moses and Elijah can dwell in these tabernacles." He totally misunderstood the importance of this glorification of Jesus at that point. He thought the kingdom had arrived and he was going to build permanent residences, in a sense. And then in later, Peter, when Jesus had said, "These things are going to happen to me," in Matthew 16 at verse 21, Peter said, no, these things aren't going to happen to you, and you're not going to suffer. The Messiah can't suffer. The Messiah can't be killed. And of course, Jesus had to had to say to him, "Get behind me, Satan," because he knew that Peter was being tempted. So first Peter tried to say, "The kingdom's here, let's build these tents or tabernacles or little dwelling places." Then when Jesus said that he was going to be lifted up, Peter said, "Oh no, these things can't happen." And then the third time he attempted to derail it was in the Garden of Gethsemane, when the band came to arrest Jesus. And what did Peter do? He struck off the ear of the high priest's servant. And Jesus says, "No, Peter, you can't at this point derail my ministry. I've got to go to the cross." And Jesus actually healed the man's ear. And so let's not be too hard on Peter. He had good intentions. He just didn't have a full understanding. His intentions were basically to glorify Jesus and as the Messiah, but he didn't understand the means that God was using to bring about his purposes. So it's a good reminder for us that God's providences sometimes are things that we don't necessarily like, and we wonder why these things happen to us, and we find them perplexing. Well, let's not be like Peter and think that we can derail the plans that God has for our lives. So what is it that must be that is decreed here? So we're going to look at these things. So he must be delivered. We've seen that. Secondly, so the second thing is he must be lifted up. He must be lifted up. And he makes that prophecy in the passage we read in John 12. He must be lifted up. Well, lifted up on what? On a tree, on the cross. And that's in a fulfillment of a prophecy that is given in Deuteronomy, which is to be lifted up on a tree and is a curse. And so he was to be cursed. What king has ever defeated his enemies by slaughtering himself? What king falls down and says, "Okay, we're going to win the battle"? What king ever does that? I was thinking of a very practical analogy. There was concern with, what's the captain of the women's team? Plurd, was that her name? Of the hockey team? Well, Poulin, right. Everybody was concerned that when she was injured, leadership is gone, right? And Crosby, the same thing. If he's injured, the leadership is gone. What king falls down and says, "We're going to win," or "I'm going to be defeated and we're going to win"? Kings just don't do that. That isn't how they do it. And if a king fails, the soldiers scatter. In fact, that's exactly what happened. When Jesus was arrested, everybody fled from him. His disciples fled. But we know the rest of the story, don't we? Because when he is lifted up, there's so much going on there. It's not a disaster. It isn't a setback. It isn't something that was unforeseen by God. It is exactly what Jesus was sent to do. It was absolutely essential. The Son of Man, the Son of God, must be lifted up. He must be delivered, and he must be lifted up. So what is it? Why is it essential that he must be lifted up? I'd like to suggest a few reasons. One is that it superseded and brought to an end all of the 2,000 years of sacrifices. The sacrifice that Abraham was led to do on Mount Moriah, and God had tested him by asking him to go and sacrifice his son Isaac. And then God held him back and says, "No, I'm not don't want human sacrifice. I was testing you. And then he supplied a ram as a substitute. So all of that from then on was pointing to the one human sacrifice that God was going to accept. And that was the sacrifice of the God-man Jesus. And there's an irony in this. Jesus was lifted up outside of the city, not in the temple where the animals were sacrificed. He was outside of the city. And Paul uses this in Hebrews as guidance for us. We must go out and suffer in the same way. And that's in Hebrews 13 at verse 12. And so what Jesus is doing here is why he must be lifted up is to supersede all of the animal sacrifices. The second reason why he must be lifted up is as a substitute. Paul says that the blood of bulls and goats, thousands of bulls and goats, millions of bulls and goats over the course of 2,000 years could never, never pay the debt of sin. And so Jesus is sent in the place, and he is a substitute for us. He stands in our place. His perfect life, his perfect obedience is accepted as a substitute for what God demands of us. The third reason why Jesus must be lifted up is to satisfy the divine justice. Ezekiel says that the soul that sins must die. Any sins eventually must lead to death. And that goes right back to the garden. If you eat this particular tree, the tree of good and evil, surely you will die. Hebrew is actually dying, you will die, meaning it's definite but not instantaneous, because Adam lived, 930 years or something, eventually died. And so the satisfaction that is here is that he has died and paid the debt of sin for those for whom he died. He has satisfied. And then there's a fourth reason why he must be lifted up, and it is to provide a standard, a model. We actually emulate Jesus. That's what we're called to do. To go outside the camp is what Hebrews says. To display spiritual humility like Jesus did. And to imitate Christ. Paul says, I imitate Christ, and therefore imitate me, imitate Christ. So he's giving us a standard. Now, keep that in mind, because there's a counterbalance to that, which we're going to look at in a moment, but